Thank you, Reverend.
All right, what's up, everybody? We are back in the Fool Button. I am with Tuan, and I'm going to pass it over because we got a very special guest. He flew Airplane Cheeseburger, named after Tuan's favorite bathroom song. What do we got, Tuan?
So I'm actually really excited about this one. I want to welcome Michael Lofton to the podcast. What's up, Michael?
Yeah. Hey, guys. It's great to hear your voice. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being on. And so just a little bit of a background from kind of some of the research I did. So Michael flew for Jimmy for a couple tours back in the late 70s and then went on to basically do all the air travel consulting for Jimmy and the band for the next, 10, 12 years, Michael?
Right. Up to 91, all during Bobby Lieberman's tenure as road manager.
Wow. Very cool.
91. Wow. I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah. And actually I flew him personally for 2 years, 78, 79 in the Cheeseburger airplane, and then moved on to being a flight. I guess you might call it an overglorified flight consultant, if you will, an overglorified travel agency.
Babysitter.
Yeah, it's a babysitter on the airplane side for all the ramifications that take place there.
So, Michael, how did that get started with Jimmy and everything?
Boy, it was kind of a strange trip and a very synchronized one, too. I'm sure you guys can understand synchronicity, the way it works. Just you wonder how you end up at a certain place, and in retrospect, you're going, oh, wow, I was there. Yeah. And essentially, I lived in the Southern California mountains called Crestline before moving up to a little place called Big Bear in Southern California, where I did a lot of flight operations. Crestline was a little mountain town in Los Angeles, about a two-hour drive down to Los Angeles, the heart of Los Angeles. And it was up in the mountains. And I remember going to a party, a backyard party, one day. It might have even been a wake, but I was back there and I noticed one of the songs a lot of people were singing to, and I've never heard the thing. It was called Margaritaville.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just thinking, well, that's interesting. And so I asked, what song is that? And I go, oh yeah, it's a new one by Jimmy Buffett. You know, have you never heard it? And I go, no. You know. 6 months later, I get a call from a music agent from the East Coast. I was out there living in the West Coast at the time. And he goes, I was also doing flights for fishermen. I'd taken fishermen in private aircraft to Baja, California. Okay. And I was flying as a subcontracting pilot for Go Enterprise that flew big Viscounts for major music entertainers, which included flights I flew for Lou Rawls, the Commodores when Lionel Richie was with them, as well as I almost flew Elvis.
Amazing.
I was flying out one day and getting ready to fetch Elvis's crew, not Elvis himself. He flew in his own personal jets, but got a call back from the main office to come back to the airport in Burbank, and they wouldn't tell us why we're coming back. And so we land the airplane and get off the airplane, and the captain and I go, what's up? And they go, well, you almost got a chance to fly Elvis, but he just checked out.
He sailed on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had flight experience up to that time being a certified flight instructor. I grew up just going to college, becoming an airframe and power plant technician that allowed me to work on airplanes. And then subsequent to that, after a few years, became an inspector that allowed me to sign off airplanes as well as experimental aircraft. Wow. And so I was doing that with a couple of flight schools, and actually had this charter company with another associate that was backing it, flying fishermen down to Baja, as it comes back in a circle again. And I'm sitting there at this party, and I'm thinking, okay, Jimmy Buffett. So 6 months later, this agent from the East Coast calls and says, I got your name from Go Enterprise, and they said that you're doing some flights for, you've done some flights for them and you have an independent charter company. Can you handle a charter to fly an entertainer on tour? And I'm thinking, well, I didn't really answer him just yet. I go, who's the client? He goes, a guy named Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah.
And I go, first thing I said was, Jimmy who? And then when I said that, I go, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I knew this name from somewhere. Oh, yeah, the party. Yeah, okay. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't have a plane. But I'm also a young buck that's kind of moving up in the industry. And, sure. You know, when you're young, you're looking at doing what you can do to make the next step.
Yeah.
And so for some reason, the universe just said, just go for it. And I said, yeah, I can put something together for you. And the guy says, okay, great. I'm going to send you the contacts and you can go from there. Well, this was a couple, 3 month lead. This is a good 3 month lead, which is kind of nice. But this is when Jimmy was moving up from actually very small aircraft. And Bobby can tell you what those aircraft were. They were before me, a Beech 18 or a King Air or something else. I forget. But this is the first big aircraft he would have moved into. And that was for the Son of the Sun. You had to be there tours. And so I'm thinking to myself, oh, shit. Okay, I just said I'm going to be able to do this. Next thing you know, I'm actually within, believe it or not, within a few days, I get a call from an investor. And I had run some little ads in local newspapers about, you know, buy an airplane, get a tax write-off. Because even now, I'm not sure how it is, but back then, somebody in a right tax bracket could basically purchase an aircraft and write it off within 3 to 5 years.
Wow.
And so that makes for a pretty good write-off for somebody. But of course, when they resold it, they would have to be recaptured for any sort of profit or whatever. But at the time, this guy was calling. I'm thinking, okay. I was thinking he was just going to look for a little airplane. He was just needed a little airplane for his write-off. And I just off the top of my head, I go, would you be interested in looking at purchasing a larger aircraft for a tour that's guaranteed that's coming up in a few months?
Yeah.
And he goes, what's the price range? And I forget what the original, I know you want me to tell you, but I can't remember the original price on the cheeseburger F-27 turned out to be. But it was right in his pocket. He goes, that's exactly what I'm looking for. I'll back you purchasing the aircraft. You put the lease back together. I was leasing the aircraft back from him.
Okay.
And so I basically worked with him. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, that's great. Where the hell am I going to find the airplane? I got the money. I don't have the airplane. I mean, at the time, man, I was living on tofu, you know, I was just getting by. I had enough to get me to the next rent. He was ready to go. Next thing you know, I'm searching. I locate this aircraft in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's a Fairchild F-27. It's a twin-engine high-wing turboprop aircraft. Originally sat 35 to 40 seats in a regular commuter configuration.
Okay.
But this was one of the few that was out of the manufacturer with an executive interior 18.
Okay.
And I'm going, okay, well, that's interesting. Because the entourage was 15 people to start with Buffett for the tour.
Okay.
So that had to be
what? The band and some of the close inner crew, right?
Exactly. You know, like the stage manager, Hobbit. I don't know if that name ever come up.
Okay. And Lip Balm, right, Bobby?
Bobby, no groupies.
Sure.
Maybe a girlfriend or a wife. Very rarely would the guys bring their wife, though. So 15 people was the approximate entourage for Jimmy when he started off at that tour. And so this airplane was fitting the pocket. The next thing I know, I'm on the horn to this outfit in Minneapolis called Hubbard Broadcasting. It was an ABC affiliate back when they only had five channels, if you can believe that, for TV.
Yeah.
I got a hold of that outfit and they said, yeah, I ran through the details on it. I said, well, okay, tell me about the plane. I learned as much as I could because I was an airframe power plant mechanic and inspector at that time. So I could pretty much rattle off everything I needed to know about the airplane. Excuse me. And it ended up being one that was low time because it was an executive out of the manufacturer. And it didn't fly a whole lot, but it flew enough. And it had plenty of backing with this corporation to make sure the maintenance was up to speed. And I'm thinking, wow, this is cool. And so I made an arrangement to fly from Los Angeles to Minneapolis in the winter, the end of 77, and landed, nice snowy day in Minneapolis, went over to the airplane hangar, looked at the aircraft, and there was some vibe I got as soon as I walked in the airplane. I'm going, this has got to be it. It was just, it just had the vibe of this is a perfect rock and roll airplane. Yeah. The engines were the same motors that you find on the Viscount, so I was used to those engines. The Rolls Royce, basically, and the turboprop.
Okay.
And you know the difference between a turboprop and a turbofan, right?
I do not.
It's basically a jet engine, like a turbojet or a turbofan, what you see on the airlines now or the airplanes, but it has a prop driving it instead of blowing air out the back end.
Okay.
So it's a turbine with a prop. They call it turboprop. So I get back there. I'm inspecting the airplane. I went through the stack. It took me a couple days to go through probably, 2 feet of paperwork because airplanes have a lot of paperwork to them. Checked out all that. Next thing you knew, I got a hold of the investor and I said, this is it. This is the one. And he goes, okay, I'm wiring the money. And so he wired the money. And the next thing I had to do is figure out, okay, how am I going to get this thing back home? And I was able to subcontract the pilots that were there with Hubbard Broadcasting already. And so they worked with me to fly the airplane back, got it back to, where did I park that thing? I originally brought it back to Ontario, California. And I think I subsequently parked it at Palomar Airport down near Carlsbad, which is kind of halfway between LA and San Diego.
Okay. Yeah. So do you remember the first trip that you took with Jimmy? Like where you went?
Well, yeah. So this is the whole thing. So I had to hire the pilots. Okay. I found the pilots, checked myself out in the aircraft, did all the negotiation downtown with frontline management. Have you ever heard of frontline management? That was Howard Kaufman and Irving Azoff. Yeah, I remember that.
Okay.
And I walked into their office. I didn't even have a brochure, guys. I walked into Polaroids of the airplane.
Yeah.
And Howard's, but I just had a good talk, I guess. And Howard saw that I was safety minded because I had a background of, being a mechanic and inspector and I was hiring, I had the right pilots and I'm sitting there in the office and Irving Azoff comes in. He says, Irving, meet Michael. He's going to start flying Jimmy here next month. And he goes, okay, let's get Bobby on the phone. So they called Bobby Lieberman. And they introduced Bobby to me and says, here's your aircraft pilot that's going to be taking care of you. And he's going to meet you in 1 month ramp of, to get back to your question, Jay, after a lot of checking ourselves out and getting some time on the airplane and getting it up to snuff, including hiring a stewardess, which is a whole nother story. That's the stewardess story. But the fraternize stewardess story. We met, picked up Jimmy. His first date was Rockford, Illinois. Remember that?
Rockford, Illinois. Okay.
So we landed The co-captains I hired for the first few legs, including myself and the one stewardess, landed, got off the aircraft, and I was going to meet Bobby and Jimmy on the ramp within about 2 hours of landing. I think we got there two, and they were set to leave around four-ish, maybe after four, to get them down to the next gig. And I forget where we were going. It wasn't too far down the road. Might have been in Ohio or something. And for their sound check to do the gig that night. And they came onto the airplane, and the interesting thing was on the side of the airplane, back when we bought the airplane, if you remember, Hubbard Broadcasting owned the aircraft. Let's talk about synchronicity. I didn't know what to do with it. Had the emblem HB on the back of the air stair in the big gold letters.
Right.
I'm about ready to paint them over white, just cover the empennage so it matches the empennage. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute here. I could just take off the left side of the H and the little crossbar to the H, and now it's JB.
Yeah. That's perfect. That is universal.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so when, as soon as Bobby walked out, he goes, look, Jimmy, your initials are on the tail. And Jimmy turns to me, he's going, Lofton, nice touch.
Wow.
So was Jimmy flying at this time? Did he have any experience at all yet?
Not that I noticed. I subsequently spent a little time with him in private aircraft myself. We flew a couple times where I'd have him sit in the left seat because I was a certified instructor then. So I could let him fly. And he was, and that was just a couple little jaunts around the L.A. basin. We went to, in fact, went to Bobby's wedding down in Del Mar, I think it was. And I got Jimmy to fly there to Del Mar. And he was still, I could tell at the time, he was still just totally just fresh at it. So I was working with him before he ever got his license, that's for sure.
Gotcha.
And Michael, what year was that again? Was it 77?
I want to say it's 78.
78.
It's very beginning. I'd have to pull out the tour book and look at the actual launch date on that.
Because it was the 78 was the Cheeseburger in Paradise tour.
Right. And then 77 was the end of, was that the summer? The 77?
You know what? I'm looking at the tour for 78 right here, and Rockford, Illinois was on March 4th, 1978.
There you go. That was the launch date.
Okay.
And that's when the Cheeseburger launched as the official Cheeseburger aircraft, Fairchild F-27.
So that was during the Son of a Sailor tour. All right, yeah. So I'm really intrigued. I got to hear the stewardess story.
Yes.
Stewardesses. They were not required on the aircraft legally from the Federal Aviation standpoint, because we operated under, at that time, was called Part 91D Large Aircraft Leasing Rules, which subsequently become Part 125, and I believe it's still 125. But essentially, I drafted two contracts with the Buffett management. One was for the aircraft, and one was for the flight crew. You had to separate them. And so we subcontracted with Sales and Concert was one of – they'd always change their name every tour to new LLC. And I think that was primarily, obviously, for taxation reasons and liability reasons, keeping the corporation separate, you know, for each tour.
Right.
I don't know if they went on to keep doing that, but I know a lot of our tours were done under certain LLC names. But so the 91D aircraft did not require, like you would find under, like, airline requirement to have a certain amount of stewardesses for a certain amount of people on board. So it was kind of just one of those added entities in the aircraft to take care of, basically taking care of getting the food, distributing food and drinks, helping answer any questions that need to be asked about something or another to do with the flight or how long is it going to take or have you, and some safety parameters, making sure that everyone's seat belted for departure and landings or any sort of rough air, making sure the air door is closed properly and locked. But beyond that, they actually become a, I guess you might call them jailbait.
Right.
And boy, they sure did for a few of the members in the band. I had warned, see, I'm the one running the show, so I'm trying to warn the stewardess. I go, you cannot be fraternizing with the band. You have to, we're going to our own hotels, not the same hotel, which is most of the time.
Uh-huh.
You're not to party with them on a night that we have a flight the next day. You're not to be, basically, if you can help yourself, you're not supposed to be, you know, going and sleeping with anybody.
Right.
And I think about the fourth day, she broke every one of those rules. So So within about 2 weeks, it got gnarly because a couple of band members were pissed off because one of the other band members had privied where the other one thought they did, you know.
Yeah.
And so Jimmy comes to me one day, he's going, Michael, we got to do something about the stewardess. She's causing havoc. And I go, I understand. He goes, so basically, you got to fire her. I said, are you guys okay if we don't even have a stewardess in the back? He's going, we don't need a fucking stewardess. You can close the door like you always do, the flight, you know, which we usually do, even though she's there to kind of check it. Like making sure that somebody doesn't get too drunk or high or something and tries to open the door, which is not going to happen, you know. And so I ended up firing her. I hate firing crew people back then, but she was bawling and it was a big deal. And I said, can I go for the just two more flights? I go, no, you're on an airline. Here's your ticket.
Yeah.
And that was that. So we ended up stopped the co-captain and I on the way to the flight stopped at a deli and got the food we needed, which was just nothing more than finger sandwich, no pun intended.
Sure.
The drinks were mostly on board, you know, local newspapers. That's all they kind of wanted, because for the most part during the flight, they pretty much could take care of themselves, you know. Most of them were playing poker or reading Reader's Digest, which people go, what? They're reading Reader's Digest? Aren't they like partying? Well, they're kind of semi-partying, but they're partying without groupies around them so they can be themselves.
Yeah. And I can imagine.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
They didn't need a stewardess. And so we survived for quite a while after that, zero stewardesses.
Now, was that how Club Oreo was born, Fingers Private Club?
Yeah, I don't know. I think a little bit about that. Yeah, I know Club Oreo kind of developed. It became part of the airplane, but I believe and Bobby would have to answer that one. I believe it took place prior to the airplane, but
In the bus.
Okay, there you go. And it certainly was the backside of the airplane. All the windows, Fingers would cover up in aluminum foil, so it was nice and dark.
Yeah.
And the airplane would have all these placards along the wall as they went along the tour that would end up being stuck on the wall, you know, little sayings and stuff. And for sure, one of the most prominent ones was Club Oreo here.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
so we definitely had Club Oreo on the cheeseburger airplane.
Now, so Michael, you did the Son of a Sailor tour and then into You Had to Be There tour?
Right. Yeah. I think it ended in late 79.
Yep.
So you were on the plane for how long then with Flying Jimmy?
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. 2 years.
And then you went on to just arranging all the air travel for him for the next 10 years or so?
Right, exactly. I'd be the one that located the aircraft, checked out the pilots, made sure that all the safety parameters were met, make sure that the insurance information and clauses were taken care of, made sure that all the contracts. I was the one in the middle negotiating all the contracts between the attorneys for Buffett and the attorneys for the private aircraft charter or the leasing company or the charter company, was handling it for their attorney side. The accountants for both sides, the flight directors for the aircraft charter side, they would have their own flight, you know, department dispatchers, they're called. And I would be the one that would be in the middle between the aircraft operations and the tour manager. So Bobby would always be talking to me.
Yeah.
I would handle, if there was any changes, like there'd be occasional weather changes, like a weather pattern would come in where we mm-hmm. knew that we would be screwed the next day if we tried to spend the night in that town to leave the next day, we would have been stuck. We wouldn't have got to the next sound check or next gig. So there'd be occasional times, and manager's nightmare come. All the hotels already booked.
Right.
They're going to go back to the hotel after the gig. They're going to get up the next day, late morning, early afternoon, come out to the airplane at 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, fly to the next gig for an hour and a half, 2 hours, get to the sound check, and check into their next hotel. Whereby, if I toss a weather aberration at them, and they're okay with it because they know they don't want to screw around with weather, and sure. they have to change all that shit at the last minute. You know, it's just horrible. But it doesn't happen all the time. But, I mean, one of those things that and I told frontline management from day one, if there's a problem, I'm not I've studied too many entertainment accidents to not try to push the limit. So just to let your road manager know, if there's going to be a problem, we're going to let them know, and they're going to have to adjust. And there was no issue.
So that's a good segue into, I had a question, just some reading up on you that I did. So you were telling a story about flying from Shreveport to Orlando, and there was a Lynyrd Skynyrd reference in there. Mm. I guess you ran into some weather, and ended up being somewhere, I think, where Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane went down or flying over that area, and there's a couple other references with that.
Yeah, if you recall, Lynyrd Skynyrd went down in the south. It's a place called Gillsburg, Mississippi, not too far away from where Jim Croce went down, by the way.
Okay.
And I have to flash, here's another synchronicity universe thing. I have to flash back to the original time that I met Jimmy on the ramp that we talked about in Rockford, Illinois, when they came up and the rest of the band members started pulling up and the Reeferettes got out. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I remember flashing back when I was younger into this level of flying entertainers, working on a street racing machine in the backyard of a house, listening that Jim Croce died and Lynyrd and the fact that I'm thinking to myself, well, I'd like to do that one day, but not crash the airplane.
Right.
And, sure. But then 6 months, I think it was like, it wasn't but 6 months or a year before Buffett, before the tour started. That's when Lynyrd Skynyrd took a dive. But I remember they had two chick singers on stage too. And so when the Reeferettes showed up, I'm going, oh my God, this is like the Lynyrd Skynyrd reincarnation or something here.
Right.
Well, on that last flight you're talking about, Tuan, is when that was my last flight to fly Jimmy before I moved into the private aircraft consulting role for him. And we're flying, as you said, Shreveport area to, I think it was Orlando. And about an hour into the flight, we had a wacky thing kind of take place. The right engine on my side, I was on the pilot side, started to flare up. Or actually before that, the autopilot kicked off and the lights dimmed in the cockpit. And then the co-captain and I, he look at each other and go, what the hell? And he grabs the wheel, took over the flight, and we're thinking, I don't know. See, that seems kind of weird. We re-energized the autopilot. It kicked off again, and at that time, there's major sparks coming out of the right engine when I look out to the right. I'm thinking to myself, well, this sucks. What the hell's going on here? Now, we have been flying a long time. So when you're a flight crew that's been together for a long time, it's not like you're getting excited. You're just looking at something to determine what the hell's going on. Because you've got, you know, all the parameters that you know what the steps you're going to take when you get into an emergency situation. The first thing you do is fly the damn airplane. You first navigate. And then you start dealing with the situation at hand. About that time, Lieberman walks up front. He's going, hey, Lofton, the lights are dimming back here. I wonder what the hell's going on. And I turned to Bobby and said, just do us a favor. Get the hell out of here and go tell the people we're working on it. You know, we got a situation. And he just said, okay, got it. And so I'm looking out, and there's sparks coming out of the front end of this turboprop, the right engine. And the co-captain's going, okay, you got any information over there? I'm going, I'm still analyzing. And we go back and forth with a little bit of discussion in the cockpit. And he's ready. We're both ready to shut the engine down. Because if that happens to be turbine blades rubbing, that means that it could have a more severe reaction. The engine could start on fire and become even more severe.
Right.
And the airplane will fly with one engine. Okay. So that would not have been an issue. But we're still talking back and forth, and he's ready to do the shutdown mode. I'm ready to go through shutdown mode if necessary. And I said to him, let me take one more good look at this thing and try to hone in about what's going on. And my eye just went right to the inlet of the engine, right behind the propeller, and it was sparking right there. And immediately it triggered in my mind the answer to the situation. And I reached up to the upper panel and I called out, turning off right nacelle engine anti-ice. And the co-captain acknowledged. And I shut it off. Immediately the sparks go away. So what it was is apparently on departure, we might have picked up what's called FOD, foreign object damage, on the runway, like a rock or a pebble. And the front end of those engine inlets, high intensity heating element to keep icing from building at altitude. We were not in an icing situation, but at a certain altitude, precaution is a standard procedure in this aircraft. And by killing the switch, apparently that FOD or the foreign object damage we picked up on the runway when we departed the Shreveport Airport had shorted the wires. Act up until we got to higher altitude, density of the air is and they shorted out in at flight level of, I think we were maybe at 25,000 feet. And but it was one of those moments of like, what the fuck? And so we got it stabilized. We activated what was called a B bus, a secondary electric bus that was running off of that end. All the lights came back up. Reinactivated the autopilot. Everything remained stable for the rest of the flight. And we did not have any weather conditions that we had to deal with ahead of us. It was all called VFR, visual flight rules ahead of us. So it was just basically clear of clouds, no problem with icing. So we didn't really need the anti. We landed at Orlando.
Hey, Orlando.
Yeah, we get out, and the band was loading, and we're all saying our goodbyes and hugs, kisses after flying them, having flown them for 2 years on that tour in that aircraft, because they were not going to be using that airplane again.
Okay.
And Jimmy comes around to the side of the where the engine was, where I was looking up at. He's going, "So what happened, Lofton?" I go, I explain the whole thing to him.
Yeah.
And about that time, the co-captain comes around with a flight map. Says, "Michael, didn't you say this is about, you know, this area where the Lynyrd Skynyrd band crashed?" And I go, "Yeah." He's going, "Well, that's pretty much where we were over when all this shit." So Jimmy kind of looks at me. He's going, "I think the boys might have been saying, hey, we're here, guys. We're not going to fuck with you too much, but we're going to fuck with you."
Man, that's
rock wild. On, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, Michael, did you have like a favorite band member? Did you have anyone that, you know, kind of really stood out to you or anything like that during these years?
No, they were all great.
Yeah,
I know that's a cop out answer, but
no, it's not.
Who was the craziest?
Who was the craziest? It had to be Fingers.
Well, Kenneth Buttry on drum, the drummer, was a little out there sometimes.
Buck.
Fingers, you know, Fingers was Fingers.
Yeah.
Harry was fun.
Soul
I like
punk.
Harry.
Yeah, so
Harry
punk.
Daly.
Yeah.
Of course, the crew. The crew, you know, all the guys that were on stage handled. The sound guys,
sure.
The light guys, the stage, the Hobbit. Like I said, Hobbit was more like his personal, Buffett's kind of personal, Bobby and Buffett's personal go guy. And, I forget the names of the other guys, darn it. But they're just all good, cool guys. I will tell you a quick story about, it was funny, Jay Spell, the blind piano player.
Yes.
After a while, he came up to the cockpit and flight deck, and he have us describe what Niagara Falls. So he sat up in the jump seat, and you know, we kind of went through the whole description with him and everything. And then I remember one day at a concert, I went up to the men's restroom stall with a partition, and there's another guy next to me. And we're just taking a pee. I forgot. I didn't know who the guy was next to me. Going, and I didn't say a word. I was just breathing and taking a pee. And it's Jay Spell, and he's going, "How you doing, Lofton?"
Yeah.
I'm going, "What?" He's going, "Yeah, don't let it freak you out. I could just tell by your breathing."
Yeah. I heard a couple stories that Fingers, after shows, like in an empty parking lot, would sometimes let Jay drive one of the rental cars. And, you know, they would all, you know, kind of get a kick out of him just driving around in an empty lot. And he would kind of freak out a little bit. And, you know, they would kind of guide him, but also play with him a little bit. And it's just kind of fun shenanigans like that.
Yeah.
Everybody we talk to, you know, that when we do this, like everybody kind of says the same thing, you know, that everybody was really great.
Yeah. I wish I would have, now that you reminded me of that story about Fingers in the parking lot. Kind of wish we would have got a shot of Jay in the flight seat flying.
Yeah. Oh man, that'd be great. That would have been great. Yeah. So Michael, how does it feel to have a shout out in, honestly, what I consider one of the best live albums of all time? And I mean, I love Jimmy, obviously, you know, I wouldn't be on this podcast if I didn't, but I love all sorts of music as well. But I do hold You Had to Be There up there as really one of the top kind of live albums to be out there. So how does that feel to have the shout out in the notes?
It really feels really a privilege to me to have that reflection. I you know, it's funny because most all the bands I flew personally as well as doing all the flight consulting for, I was never really talking about them. You know, when people ask me, "Well, what's going on?" I would never really tour that I was doing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was just because I think I might jinx myself. I was just trying to be humble about it. I don't know what that was. But for some reason, I just kind of, I never really, the tour had to be in the can, done, over with. And then I can kind of maybe bring the talk a little bit up in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
But other than that, I never really, you know, once you're at that, I don't want to say it's like any big level or anything. I was just doing my job. So I didn't look at the stardom thing. I looked at, here's my job. I got to get them there safely.
Sure.
And I can't be fraternizing because that's going to turn to shit too. Sure. If you end up partying with the band every night and you're flying in the next day, that's not going to look good. So I just ended up, I totally appreciate the fact that I got name credit. I didn't even know it for a while. And then someone mentioned it to me, goes, nice credits. And I go, oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And I go, great. Oh, cool. Okay. I got, here again, it's like I said, at least I got something to fall back on to prove that I actually was there. I was there.
You were there, and you actually also have some awesome pictures, and we'll definitely, you know, if you don't mind, we'll post some of those when we put up the episode, because I think they're just really great.
Absolutely.
So, you know, obviously you've done this for quite some time, and I'm sure you have, you know, thousands of stories, and kind of brings me into the next question is, you know, you're getting ready to release a new book, right?
Correct.
And all the, you know, basically of your years of taking care of a lot of these bands.
Right. Exactly. And it's basically more of a backstage production experiences as opposed to, and it's from the technical side, like I just described up to this point. It doesn't really get in too much when it comes to star gossip. If you're looking for star gossip, it might not be the book for you.
Gotcha.
But it does have, finding that there are, you know, fans that are looking to hear about, well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that the airplane or you had to go through this kind of rigmarole or this, all these hoops to jump through in order to get that airplane to get it where it was going. And how do they, you know, what is the parameters around, what do they do about getting to the airplane and how do they load the airplane and where do they, you know, what are the time schedules that they use the airplane for? You know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I also include kind of some wacky stories, like the Skinner one I just mentioned, that kind of go part of the background of the experiences.
And when are you releasing the book, or when do you plan to release?
Looking to release October, November.
Okay. And name of the book?
Is called Flying Rocks.
Love that.
Love the title.
The site will be flyingrocksbook.com.
Cool. Awesome. Then our listeners can go there and check it out?
Absolutely. And if they go there early, it's set up for a pre-launch, if you want to get on an email list for pre-launch alert. So that's ready. That'll
Very
be available.
Cool. Very cool. So yeah, a couple other things that I came across. I did see you guys flew over Mount St. Helens after it erupted.
Yeah, the Volcano West Coast Tour. It was after another one of those synchronicities. The album after the studio situation down in St.
Montserrat.
Montserrat. And so this happened to be a couple of years later, West Coast tour in a smaller aircraft, a King Air F-90. And I was a co-pilot on that one. That was just the acoustic band. So that would have been, you probably know that better than I do. Basically, Clayton was on it. A couple of the other, just basic, Utley, of course, and Jimmy and Bobby and I forget who else was on the acoustic tour, but it was a short tour out of the West Coast, up and down the West Coast. And about the third leg or so, this is just a couple years after the Mount St. Helens volcano, less than that, blew. And it was still active. It was still going on. And we departed out of Portland this afternoon. I got to thinking, I looked over and I could still see smoke coming out of St. Helens. And I turned to the captain. I go, why don't we get on flight following and see if we can get at least close to that and see if Jimmy wants to check out the volcano. And I got on flight center, flight following, and they said, well, yeah, you have clearance. You can go over there if you want. And I turned back to Buff and I go, Jimmy, you want to go fly over the volcano? Volcano, hell yes!
Yeah.
So we beelined it to St. Helens on our way up. So we diverted over to St. Helens. Found out the minimum altitude, but we did hear scuttlebutt that if we turned off our transponder at a certain point, which is their altitude indicator as well as a locator for the flight following people on the ground, we could actually go as low as we damn well wanted. So we did turn off that transponder, and we did go low, and we circled right around down, still see it bubbling.
That's got to be pretty cool to see from the air, huh?
Totally. And I had Jimmy sit in the right seat for that one.
Oh, very cool.
And I actually have a picture of him. He's in the book on that one, sitting in the right seat, looking down at the volcano. It's Mount St. Helens.
Yeah, I remember that thing blowing up.
And you were flying with them in 79, and that's when they started opening for the Eagles. Do you remember going to those shows or anything? It looks like they played one in late September in Honolulu with the Eagles.
That would not have been me. I did not go to Honolulu. I put him on a separate jet for that, not the turboprop to get over there.
Yeah.
No, I remember flying. In fact, the night of the Lynyrd Skynyrd, Little River Band was.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yep. Yep.
I remember flying Tim Weisberg with us.
Okay.
The flute guy.
Sure. Yeah.
I remember him being all concerned about his flute in the case. I can't put my flute anywhere but on top of everything. Okay, Tim. Put it on top right here. Just put it right here. Make sure you watch it. I go. Okay. I flew. Occasionally, I would go out with him after I stopped the Fairchild Cheeseburger airplane flights, just to get a little time in the airplanes and sit right seat.
Yeah,
and that was the volcano tour because it was that aircraft could be flown with a single pilot, but I prefer to always have two pilots on all airplanes, and sure. I never put out any of the older piston aircraft. It was always had to be a turbine or a turboprop before I would actually provide that sort of equipment for touring. So some of the bands, you might recall, I flew the Doobie Brothers after their first reunion tour.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
You know how reunion tours seem to keep going, and it's the next reunion tour and the next reunion tour?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, this is the first one after they sold their Kruby liner and their Doobie liner, and those were piston engine airplanes. And I told management at the time, I'm going, I'm not putting you in the piston airplane like you used to have. And so I ended up putting them in a Viscount, four-engine aircraft. And so where was I going with that? Just the fact that I pretty much stuck with, I have a story. I don't know about, we have time to go into it right now. Rick Nelson, if you remember Ricky Nelson from the Ozzie and Harriet days.
Yep. I remember that.
Okay.
And unfortunately he went down in DC-3. I tried to talk his road manager out of it. That's part of a story in the book. Unfortunately he didn't want to listen, and I wasn't the only one trying to talk him out of it. I knew other consultants that did the same thing. It was just an unfortunate event. But so that's why pretty much I learned to just stick with turbine aircraft because they were safer. And nowadays, you know, that's all you can get is turbine aircraft.
And Michael, you are a musician yourself, right? Don't you play in a dead band? Tell me that.
I actually am a drummer for a Grateful Dead cover band, not a tribute band, but we do covers for Grateful Dead.
Dude, that's awesome.
And I also am a host, a drum, open mic drum host. So I'm the host band drummer for open mics. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah.
There are a lot of those that are going on nowadays where the main band is there to help support anyone else who wants to come up on stage. Kind of like a karaoke, but it's live.
Yeah, that's cool.
And you're there to play songs with other people, guitarists or singers. And other drummers come up and sit in for three or four songs.
Yeah.
And then if there's another drummer comes up and three or four songs, or I go back up and sit in for a set or two because there's not enough drummers in the house. So I'm able to do that a couple times a month now. Plenty for me.
That's cool.
Just to stay connected to the whole music vibe.
Yeah.
Do they call you the bearded hippie there?
Yeah. Some do.
Yeah. Now, Michael, just to kind of wrap up here, do you have like a favorite Jimmy album, or do you have a favorite kind of song, or anything specific to Jimmy?
Well, I guess I'd have to go back to the 70s because that's, you know, for me, it was me listening to him because I was backstage all the time.
Oh, cool.
Primarily because not only because we had at full access passes.
Yeah.
And we were urged to come all the time. You guys going to be there tonight? You know, as soon as you're leaving the airplane, you going to be there tonight? And sometimes we actually had to catch up on our safety sleep, so we couldn't even be there. But most of the time, the reason we want to be there is not only because the catering rocked.
Yeah. That's so funny. Jimmy's known for his great catering, I've heard.
Yeah, so we'd make sure that we had our dinner was taken care of. We'd go to the gig, and we'd usually leave a little bit early after, you know, the crowds, traffic and that stuff. But I just reflect the times when I written early on when we first started flying them on that Rockford, you know, the original cheeseburger tour. Man, I just remember we go backstage and it was just a fun experience because you got all the people out there and still I'm thinking, all right, well, I guess these people must like Jimmy because they're all showing up.
Yeah.
And we had no idea what his repertoire was. So until after about 2 weeks of being at the concert almost every night, we knew every song. We knew what he was going to play next. And of course, with the fact that he would mention the local city and everything. But so I'm reflecting back then, and I would have to say that the couple songs that come to mind that really kind of affected me, that felt a vibe, was Come Monday and Pirate Looks at 40.
Yeah, I mean, how could you not? I mean, those are honestly probably two of like some of the best American songwriting, you know, out there. I would argue.
And of course, I'm reflecting on the universal tie that brought me to him was Margaritaville.
Right. Sure.
With the backyard party, right?
Yeah.
But my most recent song, and it only because it hit me, because I'm like you guys, I learned about the news about departure, and I just immediately, flashing back and all that stuff. But Bubbles Up, to me, just rocked.
Yeah.
It just hit the spot. It's like, he just wrote that knowing he's checking out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could just kind of tell that vibe.
And Michael, have you gone to any shows after you were done doing everything with them? Had you ever caught back up with him or crossed paths again?
I went to a couple of shows after I stopped flying him in the 90s, early 90s. But it was only because I was quite a ways away, living quite a ways away. from where the venues were. So it wasn't easy for me to just drive a few hours to get there.
Right.
But I do remember driving down Big Bear Lake, Southern California, to do an early 90s show at the, what's the big place in Hollywood there?
At the Bowl?
Not the Bowl. It's the other, I'm losing my mic.
You got the Greek Theater there.
It wasn't Greek. It was I remember it. It happens to be one of the other big ones that were right in between the Bowl and the Greek. And, you know what I'm going to think of it as soon as we're done with the end. But I remember standing, I had access pass that was after the show. It was one of those things I had no reason to be backstage during the show. Because I showed a little later, but I had the pass. I got it will call. I could have gone up to the backstage immediately, but I decided to stay out front, listen to the show a little bit. And on the side of the stage, getting ready after the show, there's a section where if you have access, you're called up. And I remember Hobbit was the guy running the show, and I knew Hobbit for years. And Before that, I was talking to a girl next to me, a nice looking lady, and she asked me, well, what do you do? And I go, well, I flew them for 12 years, 13 years, and I happened to be down in the area, and so I'm going to go back and say hi. And she goes, oh, and I go, what do you do? And she goes, oh, well, I did the Photoshop, and I forget which album it was. I did the photo to make him look better on the album.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, okay. I mean, you know, it's a new age. Maybe this is what's happening, you know? So I get up there and Hobbit looks down at me. He's going, Lofton, what the hell are you doing down there? Get the fuck up here and backstage. Yeah. I go, okay, what about her? You know, tell him what you did. And she looks at him and Hobbit goes, who are you? And she goes, okay, you're out.
Yeah,
I mean, she basically told me a story.
Yeah.
And that story was not going to fly past Hobbit to get on stage. It's amazing. No, as you probably heard, there's so many backstage. I got a way to get backstage. Just me. if you run across the right people locking the backstage, you don't have a chance in hell.
Yeah. Oh, that's too funny. Well, hey man, we really appreciate you coming on and, you know, spending your time with us and sharing your stories. And, I'm super excited for, Flying Rocks to come out. I'm going to really look forward to that. And who knows, man, I don't know. We'd love to maybe have you back on the Fool Button and maybe bring along Lip Balm. That could be kind of fun.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I could bring up a few items that he may not want done.
Right. Yeah.
We might both want to talk about it, but
we've heard some stories, man, between like what, Tuan, the cocaine football and the
hotel.
Things slipping under doors and all kinds of things. And I think Bob's also working on a book, but I mean, it's going to be just really exciting to kind of read all this stuff because, you know, as you said, like, it's cool to go back. And, you know, for me, I'm always fascinated about just the music business in general. So it'd be really cool to kind of pick up your book and understand some of like the travel aspect of it and everything.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm glad you think that there's some interest in that.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Having another little side story, I know you guys need to wrap it up, but the t-shirt story.
Uh-huh.
With the first few days or the first week I flew Jimmy, we were wearing sports coats, nice shirts, slacks, and, you know, just looking kind of semi-professional.
Sure.
And after a week, Jimmy goes, lose the suits, put on the Jimmy Buffett t-shirts.
Yeah.
And we would pull into these ramps because we were one of the biggest aircraft at the time pulling into the ramps. And of course, these other guys had pretty nice airplanes. They were in Learjets, stuff like that. But they would be full on suits and ties and lapels and, you know, emblems and all that stuff. And they come over and going, they come over, who the hell are you guys?
Oh, man, that's great.
And we'd be in T-shirts flying the biggest airplane.
Yeah, but you guys fit right in, man, with that vibe. That's awesome.
It was great. And then, of course, you've heard the Jimmy Who T-shirt. I told you that. You know, after a while, everyone asked, where's Jimmy? Where's Jimmy? We finally got so sick of that. We finally made T-shirts that said, Jimmy Who?
Oh, man, that's awesome.
All right.
That's awesome. I
appreciate you guys doing what you're doing. It's great.
Man, thank you so much. And like Jay said, thanks for taking the time and joining us tonight.
Appreciations. Totally. Appreciate the flashbacks. And keep on keeping on.
Thanks, man. Well, awesome. Everybody, that's another episode of The Fool Button. Thanks for tuning in. We hope to see a bunch of you all at the show in Nashville in a couple weeks. And just really excited about that. Party on, Twan.
One times. Party on, Jay. Okay. One love. One.
Thanks for listening to the Fool Button podcast presented by the Songwriters Joint. Follow the Songwriters Joint on Facebook and Instagram for amazing content that features Marvin Gardens and all of his songwriting friends. Let's get together. We'll be right back.